Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the HITACH HTI2 Public Role Task Force for Group 3, focused on information blocking and TEFCA. I'm Seth Pazinski with the HHS Assistant Secretary for Technology Policy, and I'll be serving as your designated federal officer today. This meeting is open to the public, and as a reminder, public feedback is welcome throughout the meeting. Comments can be made in the Zoom chat feature. Also, there will be time scheduled at the end of the meeting for verbal public comments for any members of the public that are interested in doing so. So let's get started with our meeting. I'm going to start with a roll call, and I will start with our co-chair, Rochelle Prosser.
Present. Good morning.
Good morning. Shyla Blen. I believe Shyla is on. You're on mute if you're speaking. Okay. Hans Butendijk.
Good morning.
Good morning. I got a message that Sooner Davenport will not be able to make it today. Derek DeYoung.
Present.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Good morning. Lee Fleischer.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hannah Galvin.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dominic Mack.
Present.
All right, thank you. Anna McAllister.
Good morning.
Good morning. Katrina Miller Parrish.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chris Mork.
Good morning.
Good morning. Eliel Oliveira. Rhonda Perkins.
Good morning.
Good morning. Zanet Sumar King.
Good morning.
Good morning. And then I got messages that Naresh Sundar Rajan, Cheryl Turney, and Ray Walker all had conflicts for today, so unfortunately will not be able to join. I want to check, is there anyone I missed or any members who just joined us? Okay. And then just one quick update before I turn it over to Rochelle for opening remarks. We do have an information session scheduled for later today at 2 o'clock on the HTI2 proposed rule information blocking session. So just a reminder for that, and I will plug the link into the chat for anyone who is interested in that. That is a public session and everyone is welcome to listen in. And with that, I will turn it over to Rochelle for opening remarks.
Good morning. Seth, I did notice in the chat that Sheila Brand had her signal had dropped and she had rejoined us. So she may be.
Yes, I am.
Yes, there we go. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Last week, we had a very robust conversation about patient and their records and holding on the first part of the information blocking session. And it was so robust that I wanted to add an additional 10 minutes for us to go over the homework. It was rather lengthy. And there were a few other areas in the CARE Act and other laws that actually pertained to what we were talking about with the definition of what a patient is and what patient records are. And just wanted to afford an opportunity for any final comments on that portion before we move on to the next section. And also again to reiterate with Seth, unfortunately, we're not going to have that wonderful overview before we start talking about the HTI rule today, but it is going to be available at 2 p.m. And I really encourage all of us to attend, including those from the public. Let me see what I can do with my mic here, everyone. Let me audio settings and... Can you hear me better now?
That's just so much better.
Okay,
Yeah.
perfect. Thank you so much. All right. For the record, I was thanking everyone for being here. We are going to have an additional 10 minutes to discuss the rule update to align what a patient is with across all sections of the ONC and align, as well as we have the HTI overview that is going to happen after we meet. Unfortunately, not going to be in time for this meeting, but I strongly encourage you all to attend. I will be there as well. And that will give us additional information to help us move forward through the rest of the rule. I look forward to having these additional 10 minutes to talk about any additional thoughts you may have after we went over at the homework and the different areas within the CARE Act and additional other sections of regulations for us to look at to bring to the table of what the definition of a patient is and patient record, and then what the exclusions are before we move on to the next section. So I will open that up to everyone today. Seth?
Do we want to transition to the Google Doc? So I think if we want to switch screen share.
Yes, please.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
Okay, in this section, if we can go over to column G. And so last week we were able to get to the third, one, two, three, four, the fourth comment from KM talking about the restrictions. And we had a long conversation regarding restrictions and either having things itemized out or looking at the interoperability of the data elements from going to paper. Thank you, Hans. And wanting to have more transparency specifically on how a facility would write their policy after crafting, looking at the exceptions and what the actual definition of a patient is, and bringing in parents, etc. So now that we've had a chance to go back and look through the homework, I did notice that there's a few more comments. So I would like to open it up to the floor for those that wanted to comment more. I see one from LF and then HKG. Please welcome to unmute yourself or raise your hand, and I'll let Seth go in those orders, and we can have that discussion for 10 minutes only. Thank you so much, everyone. Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, I want to thank you. I think we had a robust discussion. I just want to reiterate that and thank, I think it was Seth or someone from the ONC, that logical outgrowth and the ability to comment that there are opportunities to say, not that it should in any way differ from OCR's comments currently with regard to reproductive health, but there is a way to expand it using and linking it to other regulations as opposed to statutes. So thank you. I don't know if we need to go anything, but I do still think that this should be forwarded through the committee as a comment from this subcommittee.
Thank you for that, Lee. Anyone from the ONC wish to add? Or I will open it up to Hannah.
Thanks, Rochelle. And yes, I also appreciated the comments last time from the ONC about this. And I modified my comment, but my comment was also about expanding this beyond reproductive health services, and they gave some good context last time. There was an ask to add some of the discussion last time I had mentioned it would be helpful to reference the part of the HIPAA rule that had very specific protections around reproductive health, as opposed to just the section of the rule that mentioned the reproductive health definitions. And they did mention, Rachel mentioned that they do reference that in the preamble, but I did put in the bottom of my comment there, the 164.502 that we had sort of discussed on the call, that would be helpful. But that was the only sort of update to my comment.
Excellent. Thank you, Hannah. That was very much appreciated. As I said, there was a wonderful discussion. There's a few of us that are missing in their voices today, and we certainly will add their comments and recommendations for consideration. But is there any other comments that we wanted to have today referencing this aspect or this portion under protecting care access exception from the group? Seth, I don't see any hands.
Okay, so should we move to the presentation at this time?
Yes, thank you so much. And I appreciate everyone for the excellent work looking over the homework. I do appreciate your time, and thank you to the ONC for adding those additional contexts with the other laws in the preamble to make it easy for us to find. As we're moving to the second section, I wanted to let everyone know that as of Monday, the HTI2 rule has been published, and you're welcome to go onto the ONC website and see the updated version. And this now will allow us to move much more easier through the rule, where we're trying to do our homework as we move forward. So back to you, Seth.
Yeah, and I'll just also add that you'll see in the Google Doc and the homework moving forward, the links directly to the section. So hopefully that'll make it easier to, and they link directly to the sections that are for discussion. So hopefully it makes it a little easier to connect to the content moving forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dan Healy from ASTP to give us an overview presentation on the information blocking enhancements.
Great. Thank you very much, Seth and Rochelle. It's great to be with you all today and looking forward to the presentation. I know we have a lot to cover, so I will jump right in. If we could go to the next slide, please. So I'll be talking about two proposals that we have in the HTI2 proposed rule today. The first will be updates to the infeasibility exception. And then next, I'll talk about our request for comment on the TEFCA manner exception. Next slide, please. So here we have the conditions of the infeasibility exception. And highlighted in red are our proposed updates. So those proposals are for the A2 condition, segmentation, the A3 condition, third party seeking modification use, and for letter B, responding to requests. So I will go through each of those in turn and give an overview of our proposals that are in the rule. Next slide, please. So first is the proposed update to the segmentation condition of the infeasibility exception. This condition currently applies where an actor is not able to fulfill a request for access, exchange, or use of EHI, specifically because that actor cannot unambiguously segment from other requested EHI the EHI that cannot be made available, either by law, due to an individual's preference, or because it may be withheld in accordance with the preventing harm exception. The proposed expansion of this condition would make it applicable when the actor has chosen to withhold EHI, consistent with the proposed new protecting care access exception in Part 171, 206. and with the privacy exceptions, sub-exceptions, sub-exception D and sub-exception C. So those are the sub-exception that deals with denials of individual access on unreviewable grounds, and the other sub-exception that deals with a health IT developer of certified health IT that is not covered by HIPAA. We believe that these proposed updates would help accommodate more circumstances where another exception would apply to an actor choosing to withhold some EHI under an applicable exception, where that actor cannot unambiguously segment that EHI from other requested EHI that they are allowed to share under applicable law. And I will echo Seth's comment on the preamble and encourage everyone to review some examples we give there where we go into greater detail. Next slide, please. So this is the second proposed update under the infeasibility exception of the third party seeking modification use condition of that exception. To give a little bit of background, in the HTI 1 final rule, we excluded from applicability of this condition a healthcare provider's request for modification use from an actor that is the business associate of that healthcare provider. We also noted in the HTI 1 final rule that we may consider amending the third party seeking modification use condition in the future if doing so may be appropriate. And upon further consideration, we have now proposed to extend the exclusion from applicability of the condition so that it would not apply when third-party modification use is sought by any HIPAA-covered entity or business associate from an actor that is their business associate, or by any healthcare provider who's not a HIPAA-covered entity from an actor whose activities would make the actor a business associate of that same healthcare provider, if that healthcare provider were a HIPAA-covered entity. And we propose this change because it recognizes the need of covered entities and their business associates to regularly modify EHI that's held by other business associates of that same covered entity. It also recognizes that healthcare providers who are not HIPAA-covered entities often have similar relationships with actors who provide services that would make that actor a business associate if the healthcare provider were a HIPAA-covered entity, and that those providers may need or want a third party to modify EHI held by such actors on their behalf. Next slide, please. And this is the third proposed update to the infeasibility exception. The proposed update to the responding to requests condition. And there are two parts to this proposal that I'll talk about here. The first is the proposed update on this slide. And then on the next slide, we have a proposed alternative proposal. So to give some background first on the infeasibility exception, in order to satisfy this exception, an actor's practice must meet the requirements of the responding to requests condition, in addition to meeting at least one of the conditions of the infeasibility exception that are listed in paragraph A of 171.204. The current responding to requests condition states that if an actor does not fulfill a request for access, exchange, or use of EHI consistent with any of the conditions in paragraph A of 171.204, then the actor must provide to the requester within 10 business days of receipt of the request a written reason why the request is infeasible. And what we're proposing to do here is to modify the responding to request condition by establishing different timeframes for sending written requests to the requester based on the condition under which fulfilling the requested access, exchange, or use of EHI is infeasible. A couple general reminders as well about the proposal for this exception. The proposed revision would retain the requirement that actors communicate to requesters in writing the reason why the request is infeasible that we finalized in the ONC Cures Act final rule. And also, as is currently the case under the current text of the responding to request condition, meeting the proposed modified responding to request condition would still be required in conjunction with meeting a condition in 171.204 Part A in order for an actor's practice to satisfy the infeasibility exception. So to talk specifically about what we are proposing to retain and what we're proposing to modify with respect to this condition, we propose to retain the current requirement for a written response within 10 business days of the actor receiving a request where the infeasibility of fulfilling the requested access, exchange, or use of EHI satisfies the uncontrollable events condition, the segmentation condition, or the third party seeking modification use condition. We are proposing to revise the responding to request condition to offer actors a more flexible response timeframe where the reasons for infeasibility are consistent with the manner exception exhausted or the infeasible under the circumstances conditions. And under this proposal, the 10-day clock would start after the actor determines, without unnecessary delay and based on a reasonable assessment of the facts, that the requested access, exchange, or use of EHI cannot be provided, consistent with the manner exception, or that fulfilling the request is infeasible under the circumstances. And among other benefits, we believe this proposal would offer enhanced clarity for both actors and requesters as to when the 10 business day timeframe starts for responding to requests that are infeasible for reasons consistent with the uncontrollable events, segmentation, or third party seeking modification use conditions. And again, we also wanted to note that this proposal would continue to provide for a response to requesters indicating the reasons for infeasibility within 10 days of the actor's determination of infeasibility. So that's the first part of our proposal on the responding to requests condition. And next, we also have an alternative proposal. So if we could go to the next slide. So we also have an alternative proposal for the update to this responding to request condition. And the alternative proposal would establish a maximum timeframe within which good faith discussions and negotiations must, in order for the condition to be met, reach a plan to proceed or an actor's determination that the particular requested access, exchange, or use of EHI is not feasible. So under the alternative proposal, the maximum amount of time would be either 3, 5, 10, 20, or 30 business days after the date the actor receives any initial request, or one of those timeframes for any request that does not implicate the HIPAA privacy rules individual right of access, and the maximum timeframe allowed under the HIPAA privacy rules individual right of access provision for those requests that do also implicate it. And And with respect to this alternative proposal, we believe that the maximum timeframe requirement would create additional clarity for actors as well as predictability for requesters. So that concludes our the section on our proposals related to the infeasibility exception. And next, I will move to a summary of our proposal on the, or for our request for comment, rather, on the TEFCA manner exception. Next slide, please. And so to start with a bit of background on this exception, we finalized this exception in the HTI-1 final rule. And the exception states that an actor's practice of limiting the manner in which they fulfill a request for access, exchange, or use of EHI to only via TEFCA will not be considered information blocking when it follows certain conditions that are laid out specifically in the exception. And we are requesting comment on three conditions of the TEFCA manner exception that we can see here. So I'll go through each of those in turn. So the first aspect of this exception that we're requesting comment on is the fees and licensing. Before I get into that, I'll just give a little bit more context on that particular condition of the exception, the fees and licensing condition that we also discuss in the HTI-2 preamble. So we state that when we propose the TEFCA manner condition in the HTI-1 proposed rule, we stated that the fees exception and the licensing exceptions would not apply because we mistakenly assumed that all actors participating in TEFCA would have already reached overarching agreements on fees and licensing such that there would be no need for the application of the fees and licensing exceptions. And in response to our proposal, some commenters expressed concern that because the common agreement prohibits fees between QHINs, but is otherwise silent on fees between participants and sub-participants, the proposal could allow actors to charge fees to access, exchange, or use EHI that did not comply with the fees or licensing exceptions. Some commenters also expressed that this could have the effect of disincentivizing participation in TEFCA and could cause actors to use other options of electronic exchange outside of TEFCA, where the actors believe that fees and licensing exceptions would apply. As such, in the HTI-1 final rule, we finalized the TEFCA manner exception to include that any fees charged by the actor and any licensing of interoperability elements must satisfy the fees and licensing exceptions. And we're requesting comment now on whether there are drawbacks to applying the fees and licensing exceptions, and if we should continue to apply them to the TEFCA manner exception, as is currently required in 171.403D. So that's the first aspect of our request for comment for this exception, for the TEFCA manner exception. And then secondly, we are also requesting comment on the limitation that carves out from this exception requests made for access, exchange, or use of EHI via FHIR API standards. We noted in the HTI-1 final rule, and commenters have stated that FHIR APIs advance interoperability to a greater degree than IHE document-based exchange. This limitation ensures that the TEFCA manner exception does not apply when a requester seeks to access, exchange, or use EHI via FHIR API standards that are codified in 45 CFR 170.215, including standards that may be updated from time to time through the standards version advancement process or SVAP. So here we seek comment on whether that limitation should be expanded to include exchange based on versions of the fire standards that are more advanced than those adopted in 45 CFR 170.215 or approved through the SVAP process. And then thirdly, we also seek comment on an alternative approach to that same API fire limitation. We note in preamble that eventually all TEFCA QHINs will be required to support exchange via fire API standards. And in time, a participant or a sub-participant could directly request access exchange or use of EHI via fire API standards from another participant or sub-participant in a different QHIN. So as part of the alternative here, we also request comment on all three of the options that are listed here and in the rule, including whether or not the limitation should remain as it is currently. So with that, I believe that takes us to the end of the presentation portion for our proposals today. So I think I will turn it back, I believe, to Rochelle for the next part of our discussion today. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. What a wonderful overview. And I already see the run of hands, as I expected that to be. So you really gave us a very clear overview and understanding. And I, again, expect us to have a robust conversation. So I will turn it over. I saw Lee, Hannah, and then Dr. Mack. Seth, to make it easier for me, if you could manage who is first, second, third, and then I can run the discussion from there. So now that we've had that wonderful presentation from Dan, maybe we can have Axel pull up the document, and I'll open up the conversation to Lee first to pose his questions.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And this is excellent and wonderful. My understanding are the QHINs are private enterprises working in a private-public partnership. And therefore, I assume that's correct, just from the ONC, before I go on.
I would have to look at the specifics of the QHIN framework that's been put out. I don't want to say anything that we haven't specifically said in the rule about that.
Okay.
But I can come back to that if we want.
So you know, the idea that the QHIN's ability, if they are private entities working in this private public private partnership, to achieve interoperability, to anchor on until they all get to the right state, we're going to stay with an older state, has me concerned. So I just wanted to express my support for not waiting and the federal government driving and the assistant secretary's office now driving the to that better state of interoperability, and therefore pushing any entities that are not there to achieve that. Thank you. So I think that was option three, if I remember correctly.
Thank you, Lee. Yes, I believe that's option three. In bringing up your comments, I also found it interesting that the omission of the sub-participant and the participant opened up this vulnerability. in that bad actors can use the participant and sub-participant rule where we were silent to then provide blocking. And so that for me was interesting and would like to have us put some comments in there now that we have more information as to why line item four is there as we discuss shoring up or closing that loophole within the participant sub-participant section. So I look forward to the comments from the group after this call on that. Hannah, if you would like to come off mute and comment.
Thanks, Rochelle. I wanted to comment specifically on the segmentation condition update. I certainly am in favor of including the proposed new protecting care access exception to this. I did want to ask either Dan or perhaps other members of the group, I'd love a couple of examples for the privacy sub exceptions and where those might be included in this update to the segmentation condition for health IT developers and specifically non-HIPAA covered health IT developers. I think that would help flesh this one out for me a little bit more and help me understand it. So Dan, I don't know if you're able to give that example or if there are others on the call who have a couple of examples there, but I've not quite sort of clarified my comments on this particular one in my head because I would love a couple of examples of what you guys are thinking here.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the comment. I think what I would do with that is actually, if I believe we're on the Google Doc, I can point folks to where we talk about a little bit more of those examples specifically, I think specifically relating to some of the things you had mentioned in preamble. And I believe it was specifically related to the segmentation condition, if that's correct. So
I've been reading the preamble here, but I wasn't able to get but yeah, if you could point me to the specific area of the preamble where you guys have examples, that would be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I can grab that specific link. I think it would be I believe it would be around here in the preamble where we kind of talk specifically about the privacy exception and some of the rationale that was sort of discussed in the preamble around that particular exception, as well as the precondition not satisfied sub-exception of the privacy exception. I would point to this, and I can have this to send around to the group as well. Thank you for the comment. I do appreciate it. Just wanted to make sure that we have that resource for you all to point to the particular part of the preamble where we can discuss some of those issues in more detail.
Great. Yeah, I found that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hannah, and thank you, Dan. I just wanted to make note for Seth that Eliel is here on the call. If we can make sure he's added to the roster of attendees.
All right, thank you, Rochelle.
Welcome. Noted. All right. Dr. Mack, please go ahead and take yourself off mute.
Thank you. First, I want to reiterate what Lee stated about the alternative section and the QHINs. That struck me also. I agree. I don't think we can wait for the QHINs. I think that actually is a blocking in and of itself and is a barrier to interoperability if we wait, even though definitely an advocate of the QHINs. But I thank you for his comments. But my question is around the non-HIPAA covered providers. Can you explain who is a non-HIPAA covered provider.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. I would have to again refer back to the specific section of that rule in terms of OCR's role, rather in terms of who would fall into that category. But I will say that in other parts of some of our information blocking guidance and materials, I'm thinking specifically around the EHI definition in some of the materials that we have put out around that. We have acknowledged the kind of the same dynamic in that there may be actors who would fall under the healthcare provider actor category for purposes of information blocking, but who may not be HIPAA-covered actors under the HIPAA rules for that definition of a healthcare provider. And so I think I would have to look specifically at the rule, but I think one of the examples that may have been mentioned were providers who did not bill Medicare, for example, as part of the practice, and may have a very specific specialized practice under which they would not fall under the HIPAA definition of a healthcare provider, but may still be considered a healthcare provider under the information blocking regulations.
Okay. Yeah, I think we need to clarify that, because I thought any provider who is communicating, sharing patient information, participating in the sharing of patient information is covered under HIPAA, has to respond to the HIPAA law. So, but we can revisit that definition. Thank you.
And I think Rachel has put in the chat for folks the link to the HIPAA regulations definition of covered entity and business associate there, just to highlight that link if folks were looking for that in the chat as well.
Well, let me say this. So HIPAA, when it says a non-HIPAA provider, I wonder, is that language sufficient? Should it be a non-covered entity? Because I mean, you're subject to the HIPAA laws if you're a provider, period. So I don't know if just the way I'm looking at it, but anybody who's a provider or anybody who's touching this information is subject to the HIPAA laws and rules. I wonder if that language should be more specific, but I'll just leave my comment there. Thank you.
This is Steve, just really quickly, there are hybrid entities that are partially HIPAA covered, as an example.
So thank you, Dr. Mack, for your comments. I think that was really good. So can you clarify a little bit when you say there are some entities that are partially covered, just for the clarity of the group? I think this really goes to the point of what Dr. Mack is mentioning, that all entities, if we're sharing private information, should be covered, whether they are a partial provider, a full provider, or anything in between. So I'll open the floor to your comments, Steve.
Sure. Well, there are, under HIPAA law, both HIPAA entities and hybrid entities. For example, any entity can be a hybrid entity where some of the services they provide are HIPAA covered, but other programs may not be. Public health is an excellent example where many of the services we provide are HIPAA covered, but many are not.
Dr. Mack, would you like to take yourself off mute? Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I'm looking at, so yeah, the service itself, but if a provider enters into that service, and we're talking about providers, right? So I guess I'm thinking if a provider is involved in the sharing of information, that comes under the HIPAA rule. So to me, when you say a non-HIPAA covered provider, that means he's not subject to the laws, he or she is not subject to the laws of HIPAA. So, I mean, and I might be reading it wrong. So that's just the way I think all providers, they're sharing information are subject to the HIPAA rules.
Right. So to provide some clarity to the ONC folks, either Dan or Rachel, or even Ben, I want to ask you, when we say the word provider, I think that's where we're a little bit bogged down. For the definition of this rule, who is the definition of a provider? And I think that will help to help clarify in this situation. And do we have a uniform one from the ONC of what a provider is? Because I think Dr. Mack is thinking this is a medical provider. And as we look at tech, medical providers and the general public can be proposing and then become subject to the HIPAA laws because we're using tech to house and transmit private information, patient information.
So without getting into reviewing what the HIPAA statute says and what its regulations say beyond what, I'll give you a quote, I'll give you a link. When we're talking about healthcare providers, there are in our rule, you will find us using language that ties to our defined terms in the information blocking regulations. Let us start with healthcare provider. It is defined in the regulation by reference back to the ONC authorizing statute, Public Health Service Act, Section 3000. It is, as we noted in finalizing the adoption of that definition in 2020, a slightly different definition of healthcare provider than you'll find in the HIPAA statute. Setting that aside, I will simply note that if you go into the HIPAA regulations, you will find the term covered entity. And the quote that I put in the chat is from the covered entity definition. And it is, you know, I'll call it the healthcare provider bullet in that definition. A healthcare provider who transmits any health information in electronic form in connection with a transaction covered by this chapter. And in that case, this chapter would be HIPAA rules chapters. So we do talk about, I would have to word search the rule preamble to see how descriptive we got about the potential for someone to meet a definition of healthcare provider, someone who provides healthcare services without transmitting any health information in electronic form in connection with any of the HIPAA transactions. I think Dan noted that we would have to look back in the rule to see how specific we got, but I think we're some of the examples that we were talking about in the preamble were simply about, you know, to illustrate maybe how, like when we talk about and we say why we're giving you an example and what it's an example of in terms of how something would work in one of our proposals. And again, I'm going to be very careful because I can't go deeper than what's in the rule. So thank you for the focusing question, and I will turn it back to you, Rochelle.
Thank you very much, Rachel. That was very informative. I know we want to be very careful to make sure that we are honoring the prior constructs of other rule determinations as we move forward in our comment sections. So Dr. Mack, if you'd like to take yourself off mic just to close this out, have we answered your question?
Yes. And I just this comment, and thank you for all the comments. So I can understand it, but it sounds like we were talking about a provider entity who would be involved. And that was under infeasibility, I think. Sounded like we were talking about a provider who would be involved in the sharing of that information. I understand if we were talking about a provider who's not involved in that at all. But sounded like the only reason we had that in there because we're talking about a provider who would be involved in that sharing. So that's what my thought was. But thank you for the comments. And that answers my question. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Dr. Mack. I want to honor and thank you for attending these. The perspective that you provide is very important to the role. And what we're doing here today. So Lee, I see that you've made a wonderful comment in the chat and just wanted to ask you to come off of mute and talk about your question about as we start developing digital apps for treatment, example, mental health, how does that fit in with the HIPAA definition for
Mm-hmm. And my former agents at CMS had just sort of approved coverage for mental health reasons. So I'm just wondering how all that fits within this definition and information blocking. And mental health is a complicated issue in particular, given some of the privacy issues. So thank you.
Excellent comment. And as I was looking through the document, I think we start to discuss a little bit of that in the upcoming topic as we move forward into the information blocking. But I do think that that is relevant to the conversation here. And I'll leave it up to either Rachel or Dan or Hannah to address that a little bit more succinctly than I could. If you would like to. No?
So I think I will leave that as a comment for now, going back to Lee's comment on mental health, just because I just want to stay within the confines of what we're proposing in this in HTI 2. But I do appreciate the comment. And as we say, all comments are welcome. And and I'll just put in a plug as well that now that the comment period is officially open, those are able to be submitted as well for HTI 2.
Excellent. Thank you. Chris, would you like to come off of mute and just talk about your comment?
Sure. Yes. Let's see. It was under the infeasibility clause. And I don't know if it's a comment or a question, that it's not clear to me how to resolve a potential tension between inducing a requester to choose certain preferences and some anticipated variation in actors' technical capabilities and operational circumstances that make it easier for some preferences to be accommodated. So if a system can easily segregate mental health information, a preference not to receive that is easy, but a preference not to receive just PTSD might take longer, and communicating those preferences creates a sort of inducement. There is a necessary tension there, and I don't know the right way to resolve it, or even if we need to, just wanted to at least recognize that technical capabilities can create incentives on the requester.
Thank you for that comment, Chris. And if I can ask the ACTAL group to please refresh the document. It's your comment is not showing on the screen, but it is showing on mine. And then go down to the proposed rule. We will see your comment there. A little bit further down, I think it's the next one. There it is. Yes. So when you're saying that there is a tension to resolve, can you just divulge a little bit further, or I'll open it up to the ONC to address this?
The tension I see is that there is a clear statement that the person holding the EHI cannot try to unfairly induce. Is that, did I get the right? Not unfairly. There is language about not inducing the requester to have or to communicate certain preferences. I think unduly influence might be the term. And there is an influence that arises out of the technical capabilities of the actor that holds the EHI. Any preferences that they can't feasibly satisfy, it creates an incentive for the requester to accept whatever that technical limitation is. And I am guessing that is not unduly influencing the requester, but I also didn't see anything that made that clear that it's not clear to me, I guess, where the limit is of unduly influencing.
Thank you for those comments. So is the ONC able to give us a little clarity around unduly influencing, or that coined phrase, in respect to Chris's comments?
So I believe what is being referenced is subexception E of the privacy exception. The current subexception E is respecting an individual's request not to share information. And I believe the part that is referenced here, I'll just read this, the first part of it. We say, unless otherwise required by law, an actor may elect not to provide access, exchange, or use of an individual's electronic health information if the following requirements are met. And number one in that list, and there are additional ones, but number one is the individual requests that the actor not provide such access, exchange, or use of electronic health information without any improper encouragement or inducement of the request by the actor. And I believe the comment is referencing is that subexception of the privacy exception. I'm not able to comment on a specific circumstance, which I believe is kind of what the comment is getting at in, you know, describing differing capabilities of health IT and potentially how those capabilities could have an effect in a particular scenario. But I wanted to flag that part of the privacy exception, subexception E, and again, can flag that section of the preamble for folks where we offer further discussion there if there's interest in examining further that particular subexception of the privacy exception.
Thank you, Dan. For the sake of the group, I would actually make that request, and so we could look into it further and provide some context. And thank you, Chris, for bringing this topic up. I think it's excellent for us to address as we move through the different areas for this topic today. Are there any other questions from the group today? I know that we basically have about 30 minutes left, Seth, please keep me honest. And I do notice that there are some members of our panel that have not offered any thoughts. and I open the floor to them.
It looks like Hans has raised his hand.
Excellent. Hans, would you like to come off mute and make your comment?
Sure. This is not a question, so that's why I did not raise anything before, but just a couple of comments that I put in the spreadsheet to just highlight them, and then we can discuss them further later. The first one, generally, is that made a supportive comment that where the exceptions are defined and some of the clarity to help reduce the pressure or the sense that we would have to go to paper for sharing certain data. So ONC offering that flexibility is positive. So I think we want to acknowledge that as well, that that we're looking at making it easier, not harder, even though it's sensitive data that may be involved in some areas. This is a more a specific one that is not about the actual intent. Generally, we don't have a lot of feedback in where we have concerns with the enhancements, but around the segmentation that's on row five, that segmentation using that is in many ways analogous to infeasibility. So aligning the timelines there would be helpful to recognize that. And I think it's the last one and this is when we're looking at it, the requester preferences exception, that seems to effectively be a duplication of what content and manner is already achieving. So to us, it's not totally clear what really the difference, the add-on is between what's already there, and then by adding this, what else is really happening? As we're going through it, we're not seeing anything new, so unclear why it's needed. So that's more of a avoiding ambiguity or potential confusion by having something that's in essence the same as what's already there. So those are really the comments or the thoughts that I would bring to the conversation at this point in time.
Thank you, Hans. ONC, would you like to provide feedback or additional comments from Hans at this time?
I don't think I have an additional comment other than just to, you know, to say that we appreciate the comment and you know, encourage all comments to be submitted as the group works through these, you know, particular issues as it pertains to each of the exceptions and sub-exceptions that we discussed.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. Is there anyone else on the group that would like to provide a comment at this time? Eliel? No? Okay. For me, I was looking at, we were offered a choice of looking at the three areas under the TEFCA, the TEFCA rule of keeping it with TEFCA and the QHANs, allowing the fire to expire or just going forward with the fire. Are there any thoughts on the group today? Thank you, Eliel. You're driving. I will allow you to stay on mute. That's fine. Are there any comments from the group today looking at the three choices that were provided to us today, looking at the TEFCA rule? I do agree with the earlier comments that we don't want to move backwards as we look towards this rule, and if we can advance or move to advancement where technology is taking us, we can then incorporate that. But I just wanted to hear the thoughts of the group as we have a little bit more time before we get to 12:15. Lee, Ike, or anyone, Derek, or anyone that has a thought about saying we're going to follow the QHINs versus the TAFCA. Okay.
Just to reiterate, I did think we need, thank you, Rochelle, I agree entirely, that we should push the ecosystem forward. Does that mean we should put this into the spreadsheet? Is that the best way, or this is captured in the notes?
I'm trying to find it more specifically. So if ACTEL can go to that area where we're actually looking at the three choices, I think they're all individually aligned, but we don't have any comments from the group. And so because it was so nicely presented, I thought maybe we can just do that together today. So we have one for moving forward with that, but how we move forward, I would love to hear from the group. Katrina?
I'm in alignment with everything you all are talking about. I was actually, I couldn't find it on the spreadsheet to provide comment. So I guess it's in that 8-8 row, but it's not, the options aren't clearly there. But just so I understand what we mean by pushing forward, in my mind, I'm thinking that means option one, and you all, we can have some discussion on what that actually means. But the point to me is the TEFCA, the main TEFCA participant is the QHIN. And so really what we're focusing on is making sure the QHINs uphold their responsibility for the requirements in TEFCA. And that, you know, we are allowing some exceptions in the interim when that is not possible. Obviously, participants and sub-participants are sort of second and third layer participants of TEFCA, I'll call them that. And I would suggest that we are not as beholden to maintain exceptions for that wide variety of participants and sub-participants. And really, you know, the main focus I would suggest should be on QHINs. Now, I'm not sure if I'm thinking about that correctly. So I'll just put that out there. I'm thinking go with option one, but discuss, redirect me. Thank you very much.
Just to interject, I wonder if, would it be helpful to the group to go back to the slide that outlines the three options for this discussion?
Yes, please, because both slides, that slide and the slide before, we have two suggestions. One is a time frame on when they are to respond, 3, 5, 10, 15, 20, and 30. And then there were the three choices of what the QHINs are. And then once we do that, I would like to address Han's comment on the clarification of TEFCA versus QHIN, as QHINs as part of TEFCA. So ACTEL, if we can go to slide.
I believe it was, so it's the TEFCA manner, Excel, the TEFCA manner exception slide. That's right after the request. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
All right. And then down in the bottom for the alternatives, we are talking about should we sunset the API fire limitation once all QHINs can support or brokered fire, or do we do option two to sunset the fire limitations if all QHINs, meaning participants, sub-participants, and support facilitated fire exchange, or do we just maintain the fire API adoption among TEFCA entities? So those are the three. And I want to open it up to Hans to just further clarify or ask his question more succinctly to the ONC. Go ahead, Hans.
It's actually not, I'm not sure whether it's a question to ONC, and I don't want to jump the queue here either. But based on the combination of things, I have additional comments around that. I thought I heard that we need to be looking at either TEFCA or QHINs, but they're all, it's all one integral part. And actually the data holders are primarily the sub participants and sub participants. QHINs by and large, are not the data holders of which you request the data. You do it of one or more of the others. That is, to some extent or greater extent, facilitated by the QHINs. So when we talk about information blocking, the question is, well, how much could a QHIN or a network contribute to some of those instances versus how much is a individual participant or sub-participant contribute to that? And the alternatives, by looking at option one, two, and three, is that to the extent that FHIR-based capabilities are coming in play, is a question really on most of it, participants and sub-participants opening up and starting to use those capabilities. So that's why I was confused with the, that sounded like there was a choice being made between TEFCA versus QIN rather than below it. And reflecting that on some of Katrina's comments, is that if we only look at the QHINs, we are actually not looking at the main bolus of data holders that in the end are the ones that that would share or not share or limit that. Not to say that QHINs could not have some aspect in that, but that would not be the majority. I have some questions or feedback on option one, two, or three, but I can hold on that for to go back in line in the queue for that.
Thank you, Hans. That was some of the questions that I had myself and wanted some clarification on that. And Rachel has put a wonderful link to help us work through that today. And so I will then go back to Lee. No, I think it's Steve was next, and then Lee, and then Dr. Mack, and then back to you, Hans.
Yeah, I was going to say basically the same things as Hans was with respect to the way the relationship between TEFCA QHINs and the participants, sub-participants. I'm not sure in looking at option one, option two, or option three, any of them work necessarily particularly well, because if you wait until everybody, all QHINs, participants, and sub-participants support, depending on what you mean by supporting facilitated FHIR, that becomes kind of problematic if you're looking at the bridge between sub-participants and participants and the QHINs about facilitated FHIR and who's doing what translation of services. In other words, if we're looking at a QHIN to QHIN transaction using FHIR and then translating it back into a non-FHIR transaction for the receiving or the potential respondent to a request for information, receiving that response in a non-FHIR transaction, they're going to be responding back in a non-FHIR transaction. Does that mean the QHIN is going to push the response back as a non-FHIR transaction or as a FHIR transaction? So I think we need a little more clarity about looking at this brokerage about what does the return trip look like for any response to a data request before we can really clarify whether option one or option two really can work.
Excellent point. I saw Rachel, you had taken yourself off mute. Would you...
Well, actually, I think I've been off mute on the software for a minute. I was muted on my phone. I'll just say I think you're getting into a level of detail and discussion that we want to step back and let you all have and decide what you want to say to us after you have that conversation.
Okay. Thank you so much. Dr. Mack?
Oh, thank you, Rochelle. Feel free to call me Dominic. Thank you. Definitely agree with Hans and Steven's comments. You know, I don't think we want to add to information blocking, but I do think what Katrina brought up, we need to answer and probably hear from ONC, because I've never thought of TEFCA as I know QHIN's a big part of it, but it's on behalf of the QHINs. You know, if it's to improve the broader networks and the interoperability across the nation, QHIN shouldn't be a priority. I mean, it should be a priority in carrying out the work and the message, but they shouldn't be a priority if there's another alternative to interoperability, you know, that's out there. So I do think from her comments, we need to hear from ONC what that is, because I think that has a lot to do with how we make our decisions as we go through these rules. So I just want to ask that, does ONC have a comment on that as far as like the role of QHINs as opposed to interoperability and prioritization on a question like this? Thank you.
Thank you, Dominic, and appreciate the nod to how I would address you. I appreciate that. Does ONC want to provide comment on this at any point? We do realize we only have about 1 minute left, and I do want to get to the final portion of Hans's recommendation of 1, 2, or 3, and if we have time, to allow us to discuss very briefly the decision on what that feedback should be. Otherwise, we'll have to push that to next week, next week's version in the time. And Katrina, if you'd like to, you do have an excellent question as well.
I see other hands up. I'm happy to just kind of pose the question, but yeah, I'm just sort of wondering the tech specifics of the sub-participants and whether they have to be in fire exchange with the QHIN, or really the QHIN can be doing it without the subs and the participants doing it.
Excellent question. So Hans, before we get to you, I just want to hear what Derek had to say, and then we'll come back to you for a moment.
Sorry, Hans, I cut in front of you. I didn't try to.
We probably say the same thing.
Wanted to, and I agree with your Tom and Katrina. That's one of the things that I wanted to bring up, because Epic's in a unique situation where we are both the QHIN, but we are also the participants of our QHIN. So from an Epic perspective, option one and option two are basically the same thing. But Katrina, you bring up a good point, and that's really how I view the QHINs and how TEFCA has been architected for that reason, is to allow flexibility for certain participants to have that flexibility with different QHINs. I think my recommendation would be option one for that, because if the participants can't support FHIR, or they're doing more of a, they're supplying data to the QHIN to serve as their FHIR server for TEFCA, that would be still an option to do that. But I just wanted to share that very supportive of removing or sunsetting that restriction that's in there today, whether it's option one or option two. I don't think it matters too much for at least our scenario here at Epic, due to how our QHIN works. But I could be convinced either way with option one or option two.
Excellent. Thank you so much for those comments, Derek. And Hans, after you speak, I would like Maria to take herself off mute and pose her question. Go ahead, Hans.
Yes, I'm going to follow up a little bit on Derek's, and might complicate a couple of things. It taps into Katrina's question as well. The QHIN sits in the middle between participants and sub-participants to share data. Step one is that it's a CDA-based IHE document exchange, not HL7 version 2. So that's really not in the picture right now for TEFCA. And that can be done, that document exchange can be done using IHE and can be done using Firebase document exchange. In that scenario, brokered Fire, in a way, would kind of be in play, because you then would effectively, currently document exchange is brokered across QEN's networks generally, Care Quality right now, Tefka moving forward with that. So there is a potential that you could say, the first step, next step is that I do Fire-based document exchange. If you are going to say, I'm going to do full Fire to Fire, then at that point in time, the first step is actually facilitated Fire that is happening first, so that rather than that, an actual Fire query against Fire US Core service is going to be partially is facilitated by a QN, because it will establish the trust, the connection, the endpoint, etc. But the participant and the sub-participant are actually going to go straight to the other party on the other side, not through the QHIN. Now, I agree with Derek that depending on the QHIN, they may have models by which, based on who is participating in them, that they could shift into a more broken mode if they want to already, and other ones are not. So in that sense, I would agree is that it depends a bit on the QHINs, particularly when you have QHINs with a very diverse set of technologies running under them, that facilitated Fire is actually the first one that people are going to hit, not the brokered Fire that might be just limited to a couple of use cases. So I think it is a little bit of a, well, it depends on how it unfolds. And are we really talking here about brokered Fire document exchange, which is different than brokered Fire? So we have to keep that in mind as we go through the options. And then it starts to look like, well, depending on what you say, we're kind of saying option 1/2, because it really depends on what you're looking at.
These are some great questions, Hans, and thank you for addressing that. And as we move to 12:25, I will turn this over to Seth. Understanding that on document page number 15, there was a question addressing the dates, and we will discuss that next week. But I would like the team to opine on the work document, so we can have a very brief conversation next week about that. And back to you, Zach. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Rochelle. And at this point, we're going to open up for public comment. So if you are on the Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise feature, which is located on your Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you are participating by phone only today, you can press *9 to raise your hand. And then once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. And while we give folks a few seconds to queue up, if they have any public comments, I just want to remind the group that the next group three meeting of the HTI2 proposed rule task force will be on Wednesday next week. So it is a change of day, so I want to make sure folks are aware of that. So it's going to be on Wednesday, August 14th from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern time. Also a reminder, all the materials from the HITACH are available on healthit.gov. So let me just check if we have any hands raised at this point. All right, seeing none, I'm going to hand it, Rochelle, back to you for any closing remarks and to adjourn the meeting.
Yes, before we do that, we did have a public comment from Maria, and she may be having some challenge on raising her hand. So I would like to read her question for the folks. She was mentioning, her name is Maria Moen, and she was mentioning that she was not sure if it is a QHAN rule to transform data from HL7 V2 or CDA to Fire. That seems to be a barrier to success. And would like to open it up either to ONC or to the group. Hans, maybe you or Ike might be able to answer that question.
Yeah, it looks like Maria may be off mute. So let me just see if Maria, if you are off mute, want to make any additional comments.
There we are.
Why technical people can't pull themselves off of mute is a never-ending mystery. I apologize. And again, I may not have the right context. I know that my organization has a registry repository, and so we have different versions of the same data available for query retrieve. We have a CDA version. We have a FHIR-enabled version. I may be misunderstanding the context, but it feels to me as though placing the burden on the QHIN to take incoming data and transform it to FHIR, that, if I'm understanding it correctly, placing that burden on the QHINs, I wasn't aware that that was something that the ONC was focused on. And again, it could be just my lack of knowledge, but from our perspective, that's a big lift. I mean, taking that raw data and then creating multiple output formats, for lack of a better word, that's a big lift. And I was just surprised by that. So that's all I had to say. Sorry.
All right. Thank you, Maria. It looks like Hans had a comment on that. And then Hans, if you want to respond, and then we'll go to Rochelle to close this out.
Yeah, assuming there's no other public comment, but I don't think there's a requirement right now that QHINs translate any payload from one thing to another. As part of brokered FHIR all the way, not brokered FHIR for document exchange, but for brokered FHIR, it would be that at this point in time, how that would seem to be, it's on the horizon, it's not the first step, but that is going to be a FHIR query that then that the QHIN would go out and query all the endpoints, bundle it together in FHIR, and put it back in a response back to the original requester. So it's all FHIR end to end, nothing in the middle. That doesn't mean that QHINs or their organizations, in some way on behalf of participants, could help with the translation. But that's not necessarily a QHIN requirement. It's more of as I understand it, a BAA relationship of that organization to do that work on behalf of the endpoint. Because within a QHIN, everybody can do very much what they like to do, what technologies to use. So within the QHIN, there's a lot of flexibility to do those kind of things. But that doesn't mean that it's a QHIN as a QHIN requirement to do that.
Thank you, Hans.
We have to be careful conflating that, because otherwise we make assumptions on what QHINs are supposed to do versus what they actually are permitted to do if they want to. And those are two different things.
All right. Thank you, Hans. Rochelle, over to you for any closing remarks and to adjourn us.
Yes, thank you, Hans, for that wonderful overview. And so in these last moments for the next steps, we will be meeting next week at between 11 and 12:30 p.m. Also at 2 o'clock today, we will be discussing the HTI2 rule. And I recommend all of us to register so we could hear from the OpenNC's perspective, all the teaching and guidelines according to that. That rule that will help us further the discussion in the HTI rule process for information blocking and TEFCA that we have going forward on the screen is the upcoming meetings. And I do look forward to revisiting slide number 15 for about 10 minutes of public and comment on the actual return dates for when the request comes in. I thank everyone for coming today to our meeting. It was a robust discussion. And if there are no further comments, I would like to adjourn.